Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Arsenal Women Arsecast on arseblog.com. After a short hiatus for the Women's World Cup, which we will talk about a little bit in this episode, I just felt that there are loads of podcasts during the Women's World Cup and it doesn't feel like a very club football-y type of time. And I kind of knew that in terms of Arsenal and the transfer market, there was going to be a very distinct pre- and post-World Cup market. We will discuss a little bit of that post-World Cup market with my guest in a minute, because Arsenal have announced a signing this week, who's also a World Cup winner. So that ties up a lot of the themes we're going to talk about. We're also going to talk about the situation, shall we say, with the RFEF in Spain and everything that's been going on in there, not just for the last week, I think, but over a period of many years. And here to discuss all of that, probably the best guest I could get to talk about all of these things is Alex Ibaceta. Alex, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. Recovering from what is a six-week World Cup and then the last week on top of it.
I was going to say, are you over the jet lag yet? How long did that take you?
It took me more than I expected. I think I'm still trying to keep the early rise. I was waking up at like 5 a.m. when I first got back, and now I've kind of shifted it to like 7:30, and I'm like quite keen to keep it, but I'm sure this is not going to be the case in the next episode.
Yeah, I did not quite the same, but I think during the second week of the World Cup, I was in L.A., and my wife and daughter were in Brazil, so I was kind of working to English time, L.A. time, Australia, New Zealand time and Brazil time all at the same time. And that week felt very, very strange. And I did the same thing in LA. I was waking up at like five. I was only there for 5 days, but I was just creeping up towards like 7:30, 8 a.m. And I was thinking, oh God, no, I'm getting acclimatized to LA time just at the time I have to go home. So yeah, it's all a bit mad.
No matter which way you go.
So there's going to be kind of three parts to this podcast. We'll talk about the World Cup. We'll talk about the situation with the Spanish FA, which I know you've been across, and we have put in the show notes an article Alex wrote in The Guardian on Sunday, just gone, which I think encapsulates really that this is not just an isolated incident, that this has a lot of history, even that predates some of the, shall we say, characters that are currently in it. But first, since the announcement happened yesterday, as broken by Arseblog News over 2 weeks ago, Arsenal have signed Leo Codina from Barcelona, a centre half. Alex, you're very across Barcelona. Just your first kind of impression of the signing, the player, and how you see her fitting in at Arsenal.
Yeah, I was quite shocked by the signing in general, because I know she obviously was out on loan into Italy from Barcelona. And I think from what I heard, she was quite keen to go back to Italy and play there. So I think the Arsenal kind of interest came in at, you know, a shock for the player as well, I think. And when you balance the options when you balance the options and you have the ability to go to Italy and you have the ability to play for Arsenal, I think there's a clear and obvious choice there, especially at the stage that Leia Codina is at her career. I think her problem with Barcelona is that she was never going to be a starting centre-back with Mapi León and Irene Paredes. I mean, it's quite hard to figure out who would be a starting centre-back with Mapi León and Irene Paredes. So her problem was always time. It was always playing time. That's why she went out on loan. It's why she wanted to leave in the first place, because she was just not getting enough playing time. And you kind of saw it in the World Cup that it took that effect of, you know, her not being able to fit in at an elite level as smoothly as someone who's played all 90 minutes for a club level. But, you know, for Arsenal, I think it's quite good, especially when you look at our centre-back situation, which I don't know how depressed we want to be when we talk about it. I mean, it's definitely gotten better over the window, but I think for Arsenal, it's quite good to have Laia come in because of the standard of training that she's been keeping up for the last year. You know, she doesn't play much for Barcelona, but she's still integrated in the team. She's still got minutes, and she's still, at the end of the day, training with, you know, the best team in Europe at the moment, best team in the world. So I think it's a big plus for Arsenal. I think especially with the confidence she got after the World Cup as well is obviously a big positive.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, the Arsenal video, when they unveiled the signing yesterday, you know, made strong reference to this, to her being a winner, because obviously she's won the Champions League and the World Cup this year. So not bad. And probably a beneficiary of a situation we're going to talk about later, the fact that Mapi Leon withdrew her labour from the Spanish national team, which gave Leia Cordina the chance to play in the World Cup, albeit she didn't start straight away. So what about her kind of performance for Spain in the World Cup? Because Jorge Vilda made a lot of changes after that defeat to Japan, and she comes in against Switzerland, scores a pretty comical own goal against Switzerland, which, to be honest, was the only way Switzerland were ever going to score in that game, scores at the other end. But I guess, what did you make of her World Cup overall as well, even though we should point out Arsenal's interest, I think, predates that?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting one, obviously, with, as you said, you know, Mapi not being there. Ivana Andres also picked up an injury, which would be, she was the captain, so she would have definitely been starting with Irene Paredes at centre-back. So Laia Codina has always been this player that's been good enough to be a second-tier player, and like the understudy of, you know, and Irene Paredes of Mapi Leon, but she's never been quite there to be first-hand. So she's also one of those players that she takes the opportunities that she gets. She takes the opportunity to prove herself when she knows that she's only there because of injury or because Mapi Leon isn't in the national team. So she's always been quite keen to do that. She's done that since the beginning. When the 15 players walked out, she went in, you know, she scored a really nice goal as well. So like, she's definitely that player that knows her worth and has the confidence to know exactly what kind of player she is. And she proves it every opportunity she can. Of course, the own goal is just not ideal, but it's what I said before of the fact that she's not had a lot of minutes, neither with club or the national team. So I feel for her in the sense that she's not been able ever over the last few seasons to be able to get at a really good, consistent, elite rhythm. And we see that, you know, when players come in after injury, we see it when players just don't play minutes. When we saw it in Arsenal last season, Katharina Kuhl was just thrown into the deep end at Arsenal, and you saw the difference it made. You know, she never got minutes before that. So I think Laia Codina is a victim to that, of not being able to get a consistent run. But obviously with Arsenal, I would assume she might be consistently starting, at least until obviously Leah's back and kind of Jonas figures out what he wants to do. But I think the consistency is what she's lacking, and once she gets that, I think she'll thrive under it.
Yeah, and she's made a big decision to leave Barcelona, where she's been since she was 14, 23 years old now. So she's clearly made that decision based on playing time, which, like you, I think that suggests that while no guarantees can ever be made to a player, that she's come to Arsenal because she sees a clearer route to the team, particularly without Hafaeli. Amanda Ilicic came in earlier in the summer. She's very much a right centre-back who can also play right-back. To me, that's kind of Leah cover. We know Lotta can play on both sides, but Codina, is it right to say, even though she's right-footed, she's largely played on the left of the centre-back partnership? And that being the case, do you see her, even though she's not a left-footer, and I'm afraid I just don't think there are many of those around, as a kind of replacement for Hafa?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because obviously, I think, again, Jonas can kind of capitalize on the fact that Laia hasn't really had that consistency. I think he can kind of start from fresh and mold her into what she wants, into what he wants, to kind of make it work. I think she's not dumb and will very well know that Arsenal have Ilicic, Arsenal have Leah Williamson. You know, it's clear to anyone who does any kind of research on Arsenal. It's not a secret what our preferred centre-back pairing would probably be. It's not a secret of the players that we have in the, you know, apart from Amanda and just Ilicic, you know, Lotta, Jen, Leah, they all have their solidified positions in the back line. So I think she knows what she's getting herself into. And I'm pretty sure Jonas, as blunt as he is, would probably have told her as well. So I think she is just quite keen to play for a club and get minutes at a big club, probably in Champions League as well. So, I mean, let's not jinx that yet. But I think for her, the most important thing is getting that consistency in minutes.
And before we leave the subject of Leia Cordina, what do you see as a key, perhaps one key strength and one weakness of hers?
I think the weakness is definitely she still has a lot of nerves. As we've seen, you know, we've seen that experience that with Lotta. It's taken Lotta a few seasons to kind of get acclimatized and get the confidence that, you know, you would want to see in your center back, as we've seen in Leah Williamson. So I think that's kind of the her weakness is that, and you know, it's no fault of her own, but it is the elite weakness of just getting a bit nervous, as we saw in the World Cup. You know, that own goal is essentially that. It was the concentration, the nerves, and the I wouldn't say lack of self-confidence, because I think she has that quite a lot, as we've seen, but it's just the sharpness and the calmness that you get only with minutes, essentially. But her strength is obviously, you know, playing for Barcelona since she was 14. The style of play that you pick up naturally, you don't even have to play minutes, you just train there and you pick up the style. And obviously, you know, Leah Williamson is a person that we love very, very much, and she's good with the ball. She's technically good with the ball. She's aggressive in the attack, which is everything that Barcelona kind of trains their center backs to be, as we see in Irene Mappi. So I think that's probably her biggest strength, in the sense that you don't get players that have played with Barcelona from a very young age to come to your club, because most of them do stay at Barcelona at the end of the day, or stay within Spain for that matter. But I think it's quite unique for us to get a Barcelona defender, and it obviously plays to our strengths when you look at our midfields, when you look at what works so well with Leah in particular. So I think she'll have the aggressiveness to kind of start the attack from the back, which is not always what you get, especially with English defenders. You know, they're a bit more reserved. They're a bit more defensive. You know, this is not our problem. Like, we're here to defend, you know, our midfielders in the attack, do the attack. But I think she will be happy to start the attack, because it's within her nature. So I think that would be, yeah, I think that's her biggest strength coming into Arsenal.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the age profile of a lot of Arsenal signings, there's certainly two layers going on where there are, like Ilicic, Lacazette, 30 years old. I think Crnogorčević has been a target. I'm not sure if that's going to happen, like very much in that kind of bracket. And then like Russo's 23, Cordina's 23. You know, there were signings in January like Kuhl and Palova, who are in their early 20s. So I think she very much fits into that slightly younger core of signings, and I think Arsenal are going to want to add, according to my information, they still want something for the right back position. I don't really know whether they saw Crnogorčević. I don't know whether I need to learn to pronounce her name or not. Whether they saw her there, but I think that's another piece of business they'd like to get done. I think Gio will go back out on loan, probably to Spain as well. So I don't think there's much business left that Arsenal are going to do, certainly not before they have a deadline of Thursday for the immediate Champions League qualifiers in September, but the WSL deadline is September the 14th. And I suspect they might get one more in before that, but I don't know that for sure at the moment. So let's leave that subject to one side. And as we mentioned at the top of the podcast, you spent 6 weeks in Australia. Did you go to New Zealand at all, or just Australia?
Just Australia.
So just a kind of 1,000-foot overall, like one of the things I found really interesting, kind of covering the tournament remotely, if you will, is that like last year we had the Euros, which was all on like my doorstep, and I went to 9 games and all of that. And then the next tournament a year later, literally on the other side of the world, different time zone and all of that. How would you compare, just on the ground in Australia, what was the feel for you in terms of like the Women's World Cup as an event, and how the Australian public took to it, and travelling fans and things like that? Just your overall experience of being out there.
Yeah, it was definitely quite unique city to city. So I was in Perth, I was in Brisbane, I was in Melbourne, and I was in Sydney. And they were all quite different. It was really dependent on down the city. We're in Perth. Obviously, that's where Sam Kerr and Lydia Williams are from. So, like, everybody knows who Sam Kerr without even necessarily knowing or necessarily following the Matildas. So that was kind of the key point of everybody knew that Sam Kerr was playing a World Cup. That mm-hmm. was the epicenter of Perth, essentially. But at the same time, I was really, you know, Colombia fans. We all learned about Colombia fans. And that was kind of insane across Australia. I never realized how big of a Latin community there was in Australia in general. I saw quite a lot of Chileans as well. But in Colombia, like, I went to three Colombia matches, one in Perth, one in Melbourne, and one in Sydney. And they were all the same. It was insane. So I think it was a really good mix of traveling fans, but like for very obviously particular teams, you know, England obviously had a really big traveling fan base. Australia had obviously their people all over that would travel between the matches as well. And everybody else was local. Like every, you know, I saw Jamaican and I tried interviewing them about Bunny Shaw. No one had any idea who Bunny Shaw was, but they're Jamaican. So, because they're all just local people that want to see their country play, essentially, which I found that really interesting. So it was the welcoming of it was very particular to the city, but also, like, in Brisbane, it was quite isolated. And Melbourne is a very big sporting city. So, like, the Fed Square where the Fan Fest was, it was packed for every Matildas match in particular as well. It was just packed, packed, packed. When the Matildas won their quarterfinal, there was like fireworks and fire, and it was like really, really, the support was insane. In Sydney, it was a lot more normalized. Mm. I went to a shop. It was a book, film, and record shop. I bought a book, and the guy was like, "Why are you here?" And I was like, "Yeah, for the World Cup." And we just had about a 5-10 minute chat about the Matildas. And you can tell, you know, this guy has never seen women's football in his life before. Mm. But now he cares about the Matildas, and he cares about what happened in the last match, what's going to happen in the next match. And it was, I think that was the most impressive thing of the Australians really picking up the tournament. Again, you know, it's a very isolated event, but they really embraced it and they really cared about Australia, which I think was kind of the highlight of everything, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the fascinating thing about holding it somewhere like that, is that you do have all these expat communities. I know, for example, there's, you know, Brazil is one of the biggest diasporas in the world. There's loads of Brazilians in Sydney and places like that. And I think you do get that in Latin America, and you see that in men's sports as well. Latin American fans in particular, you look at something like the Club World Cup, which, like, in men's football, which most European fans don't care about, but when it happens, the Latin American fans, they'll sell their cars and stuff and they'll go over. Lots of Colombians in Qatar for the Men's World Cup, even though the team weren't there, just like loads of these kind of stories in these communities. And Ireland as well, a big diaspora, big Irish expat community in Sydney. So you've kind of got, like, you know, I've never been to Australia, but it does strike me as that like all these kind of melting pots, really, which makes it, yeah.
I never expected it to be that much. It is honestly impressive, the diversity that there is in Australia.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I guess, like, a question I'd have is, because I've had the sense from afar that this thing has grown and people are interested in. We all saw stats about the viewing figures and things like that. And I was talking to an Australian friend of mine who was actually involved in organizing some of the fan parks, not interested in football at all, but she got well into it. And they were talking about stuff like, for one of the games, they didn't show the 9 o'clock news for like the first time, and because it clashed with the Matildas game, all these touchstones and how it was outstripping like, other like big Australian sporting events. And there's a lot of sports to compete with in Australia, and a lot of sports that Australia are very good at as well, like rugby and cricket and things like that. How do you see, I guess, I don't know if there was any chat about the legacy of this tournament, in that the thing we experienced over here after the Euros was a big boom in attendances, but that's because the Lionesses largely play here. So like Leah Williamson and Beth Mead play at the Emirates, that sells tickets for the Emirates, whereas the Australian players largely play in Europe. So do you think this is just going to be a Matildas thing? Was there any discussion about what things might look like after the tournament?
Yeah, I think the Matildas thing is obviously quite a big focus in terms of, you know, no matter every tournament that the Matildas play from now on, they're going to have that, you know, that unwavering support. But I think it's more about the sport, like football, as you said, you know, you have Aussie rules, you have the rugby, the cricket. And for example, when the Matildas were in the penalty shootout, there was at that same time, there was a lot of AFL matches happening throughout the country. There was one AFL match where they stopped the game and showed the penalties on the big screen at the MCG, which is probably one of the most, like, obviously it's a very renowned cricket ground where they play AFL. They were showing the penalties on the screen and the concourse was just jammed, packed with people around the telly watching the penalties. You know, it's people that wouldn't necessarily care about football because they're watching AFL because that is their sport. And you genuinely saw them stop in the middle of a match to watch the Matildas win. There was an AFL match finished and there was a press conference after. The coaches and all the staff, the players, were late to the press conference because they wanted to finish watching the penalties. You know, it's like, it's a crazy effect that it's had. I met an AFL player, a women's AFL player. They said that after training, they want to start playing football. You know, after their own football training, they want to start playing football. So I think the effect goes, I think the Matildas have always had the support because they're Australian. Mm. As you mentioned, you know, you can't really support them in club level in Australia. So you have to support them on a national level. And I think they've always had that really, really strong support. But now I think the sport is the one that's advancing. It's football that's kind of becoming a more natural Australian thing to do outside of, you know, the very historic sports and leading sports that Australia has. So I think that's the effect. It's the interest in the sport rather than just the interest in the Matildas, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And again, like, we do see this in men's football. I mean, you'll appreciate with Chile as well and the South American teams, again, in men's football, like, that's why players like Alexis Sanchez, Arturo Vidal, why playing for Chile means so much to them, because they have to leave, basically. And then they come back and they feel like they owe this debt. And that's why, you know, for a lot of, again, kind of, I guess, drawing a comparison with like Latin America in men's football, that like the players have to leave, but they come back and the national teams are strong and they all feel that connection and that pride. And it must have been nice for a lot of those players as well to get a good like 3 months at home, particularly like not that long after COVID, where most of them couldn't go home for a few months. But I guess I'll ask you again in very broad terms, your overall impression of the tournament, because I think the thing I thought coming into the tournament was there are 6 or 7 teams that could win this, but I kind of doubt all of them. I think all of them have like a bit of a flaw. And to me, it just depends which one of them is going to work out their flaw in the tournament. And look, we'll talk about Spain in a minute, so we kind of know it was them in the end. But actually, I think the theme of this tournament was some of those mid-tier nations look like they're catching up. So for me, this tournament was about Colombia, Jamaica. I don't want to say Nigeria, because Nigeria actually have a very good history in the Women's World Cup, and it wasn't their first time in the knockout rounds. But just this sense that some of those teams, you know, we didn't see any 10-0s in this tournament this time around. And was that something you felt and that was talked about a lot on the ground, as it were?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's, we have to point that out, because we see from the 2019 World Cup to now how much has happened in just 4 years in terms of the level and the standard of, you know, the balance throughout, you know, the elites that have always been the elites, because they are the elite, to say the least. But it's those, you know, it's the Colombian team that have actually impressed. You know, they had, as I think anyone can agree, they had no right to beat Germany the way they did. Lima Caicedo had no right to score against, you know, these elite players. And that's just the standard that is now. You know, the US lost in a World Cup. You know, when was the last time that we've seen the World Cup crash, the US crash out so early in a World Cup? So it's like, it's I think this tournament was a really big testament to the effort that's been going on individually, whether it be national teams or clubs, as we will see now when we talk about Spain. It's a lot of work done over on women's football. It's not just particular to the national team. It's the players, you know, motivating themselves and having to be at an elite level. You know, Lina Caicedo just landed the deal with Real Madrid, but, you know, she had to get to that level for 18 years old in whatever way she could in a very underdeveloped, you know, women's football country, essentially. As much natural talent as you have, you need to get to a physical standard, a mental standard, a professional standard in order to be a professional in, you know, in a top league. So I think the mental shift that people and players have now to become more professional and more elite is quite evident. And you see that motivation because now you can go into the World Cup and you can compete. You know, Colombia had every possibility to knock England out of, you know, the World Cup, and it's possible. And that just, it's a domino effect down through new generations to different countries that you can have XYZ standard, you can have XYZ problems with your federation. But if you force yourself individually and you take in count and you're able to maximize what you have and really commit to it, then anything can happen. I think this tournament was a testament to that. And, you know, kudos to every single player that essentially proved that to everyone.
Yeah, and that's the kind of the dichotomy, isn't it? Because, like, we're talking about some of these mid-tier nations, but actually, like, you know, coming up to the mark a bit more. But I think you're right that that's kind of player-led in terms of some of those federations are not responsible for it. Like, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that, like, the Jamaican Football Federation is responsible for the performance that they put in. Or Nigerian FA, for example. And I think there's, you know, particularly around Europe, the scouting's getting a bit better. In the US as well, the scouting's a bit better. You look at Nigeria. I mean, if you told me Nigeria would play this well and Asisat Oshoala would play very little part in it, I wouldn't have believed you. But, you know, they've got players at Houston Dash. You know, you've got with Haiti, like players who now at Lyon, for example, and a lot of these kind of players. You said Linda Caicedo's at Real Madrid, a club that I think are one of the best developers of talent in European club football is Levante. They've got Rodriguez and Redondo. Does Redondo play for Levante? Yeah, and they've had Tatiana Pinto, like players who really, really play well in this World Cup. And Levante, for example, very key developer of talent. And I suppose let's talk about it from a footballing aspect first. Spain, obviously the winners overall. I have to say I didn't think they would win it, largely because I don't rate their coach. But also, I think a problem they solved during this tournament is I look at Spain and I say I see Barcelona, but Barcelona import their forwards, mm-hmm. right? Barcelona's front three are usually not Spanish. They usually get players from other countries to do that part. But in Salma Paraluelo, I don't know why that's such a tongue twister for me.
It's a tongue twister even for like Spanish-speaking people.
It's where the double L is. Yeah. I have to visualize it in my head. But in Salma, like they found like a direct player up front, which I think they've been missing for a long time. So what did you make of Spain's tournament? And I guess, I mean, they were the deserved winners, I think. Putting all the other stuff to one side, like what did you make of Spain in this tournament on the pitch, particularly with the kind of turmoil they came in with anyway off the pitch?
Yeah, it was obviously a testament again to the individual players and the player union to win a World Cup despite everything that's been happening over the last year. You know, it is quite impressive to be in a camp enclosed with the people you're at war against for 2 months, essentially, how, you know, that mental weight that you carry for those 2 months, aside from the mental weight of playing a World Cup, is, you know, a testament to how determined and professional these players are. And yeah, it's always going to be interesting to see Spain because, you know, it's either they play for Barcelona or they've played together at different times. I think the start, if I remember correctly, it was 6 out of the 11 starting lineup for the final were Barcelona players. That's obviously not including Jenny Hermoso, who used to play for Barcelona, and you have Alexis Podeas on the bench, so it could have been even more. You put in Patri and Mapi, and you could have had two more Barcelona players quite easily. So that is obviously, you know, that's always going to be a big focal point of no matter who the national team coach is, you know, these players would have won anyway. I interviewed Vera Boquete for The Guardian. She said exactly the same. She's like, it's a testament. You know, these players are at an elite level, no matter who the national team coach is. It's, you know, they're at this level not because of the federation, not because of the president, not because of the manager, but because of their individual growth. And the fact that as well that the Spain's youth teams have been ridiculously successful for a very long time now. You know, Spain is holding the U17, U20 and Senior World Cup right now.
I think there were seven players in the squad who won the Which one did they win in 2018? They won two of them.
The U17,
and the U20, I think. And I think they had seven players in the squad who won that U20 title.
Yeah, so it's you know, it's that history of it's the club connection. But it's also the fact that most of these players, because a lot of the Spanish players do play in Spain, they've played together at one point or another. They've all played together at club level, and they've all played together at international level for the youth levels. So, you know, this is not just like picking like random teams that play in, say, you know, the Netherlands, France. Obviously, women's football has a much smaller pool of where you can play. So these players have been working on this for like since the U17, essentially, we can probably say. So it is, the way they play is quite a testament to that. So it's not surprising that they're reaching their peak and that they did win a World Cup, because they've been working on this for so long. And we've seen it at club level. You know, Barcelona has been dominating the Champions League. Spanish players have been dominating the headlines. We've seen, you know, Ona Batia and Manchester United, Lucia Garcia as well, you know, Jerry Mosso in Mexico. We've seen, you know, PSG has a few players. You know, it's quite evident that this has been a long time coming, and they just needed to reach their peak. And again, this is all just, you know, outside of everything that's happened. So it's not surprising that they won, even though it kind of is. But I think it's what you said, Tim, about the fact that there were so many contenders to win the World Cup, and each of them had their flaws. And it was just a matter of which one kind of hit it better.
Yeah, I mean, I tipped Germany to win the whole thing. So there you go. That shows you what kind of tournament it was.
I said Germany winning Alex Pop Golden Boot in that really well.
Yeah, unfortunately, it kind of looked like Germany's only strategy in the end was Alex Pop or bust, which great player that she is was quite weird given the diversity of talent. Keeping it on Spain, I mean, it's strange, right? Because last year we were told, you know, I say we were told, so 15 players went on strike last September, and there have been loads of stories before that about, particularly I know like Barcelona players were getting injured, and privately there was some suggestion that when they went away with the national team, the training was so much a lower standard than it was at Barcelona that players were getting injured. There was a story that Vilda didn't show the Spanish players any video of England before the Euros quarterfinal last year. So when England stuck Millie Bright up front with 10 minutes to go, that seemed to surprise everyone, even though it was a tactic that was certainly widely known by English fans.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And then, of course, we come to the fallout. And really, this fallout, like I said at the top, is a culmination of things that have been happening for many years that even predate Rubiales and Jorge Vilda, which you touched on in the Guardian article. You know, in 2015, the players again had to get a coach ousted, and there is a documentary about Carrera, which, I mean, some of the images that accompany it are quite uncomfortable with how physical he is with players. And I guess even knowing all of that and even knowing everything these Spain players carried coming into the tournament, I'm kind of caught between feeling surprised, but then kind of checking myself and saying, am I naive to be surprised by the events that have unfolded ever since, starting with, you know, with Rubiales's, should we say, actions towards Jenni Hermoso after the game? Like, how shocked and surprised are you by all of this?
It's a weird feeling, because it's actually a feeling of relief. It's a feeling of relief of the fact that he has caused his own downfall by being himself. Mm-hmm. It's him being himself. The only difference is that there's, you know, broadcasters and cameras that are broadcasting this to literally the entire world. So it's quite poetic, almost, the fact that he's done it to himself despite everyone trying so hard for many, many years. All it took was to put a camera on him. That's literally all it is. It's to put the attention on him. It's put the camera on him and just let him do whatever he always does. So it was almost a sense of relief. Honestly, obviously not shocking, not anything, but the sense of relief that now people can kind of see and not have to take the player's words for it, even though I find it ridiculous that people don't take the player's words for it as it should be. But obviously he's done it to himself now and there's no going back for him, which is quite relieving.
Do you think, because the thing is, like, I think it's tempting as we're in the eye of the storm at the moment and he's standing around while Rome is burning around him, still saying, nope, I'm not going anywhere. I'm, you know, it's all, and all of the stuff that's unfolded ever since. I mean, has that shocked you? Like, because first we have, you know, the incident with the, shall we say, unsolicited contact with Jenni Hermoso, which, as you say, everyone has seen because it's broadcast to millions around the world. But since then, and you've been very across this, like the various statements, and then last Friday with the kind of the assembly where everyone assumed that he was going to resign. And actually, I think in the build up to that, it's like, why are you waiting till Friday to resign? Just do it now. Like, don't bother with the assembly. But clearly, he had in his mind that this was going to be an act of defiance, which he's continued. Again, does any of that surprise or shock you at all?
It does, but it doesn't. It doesn't in the sense that he's just showing exactly who the person he is. He thinks he's untouchable. He's entitled. I mean, we've seen his mum go on a hunger strike. And I think that says a lot about the way he's been raised, in the sense that he's the little boy that can never do anything wrong.
And the fact that apparently he hasn't put a call in and said, mum, actually,
yeah, no, he's don't do not. This. He said she's not spoken to him. The poor woman, you know, putting her life at risk for her son, and he's not even like called to check in on her. But no, he's showing exactly who he is, and he's showing the reason why the Federation is so rotten to the core. It's the fact that you can do, you know, such a very obvious act of, you know, an unsolicited, you know, contact, as we say it, and still think you did nothing wrong, and still think that you're untouchable, and still think that you had every right to do what you did, and that everyone who says so otherwise is lying. Like, how do you even explain that? You know, that's like almost like a sociopathic behavior of just, you know, being in denial despite literally everyone seeing exactly what happened. And but it's also, you know, apart from him being him, it's also a testament to how the Federation is inside. You know, we saw in the assembly the claps and the smiles and support that he had within the Federation, and that says exactly everything that you need to know, that these players are literally on their own within an entire Federation who is in support of Rubiales. Obviously there was talk about him leaving and the vice president to go into power, but they're the same person. You're talking about the person who's been acting under Rubiales for a very long time, who will have the same ideas and support Rubiales. So it's just, yeah, it's his confidence to feel untouchable within the Federation. because he can, because he has so much power and control over these people, it's ridiculous. But then it's also his personality of feeling entitled to be like, you know, and the way he said it as well was he's like, do you really think that this kiss would be enough to see me go? Which I think kind of sums it up quite bluntly.
Yeah, and you pointed there to probably what's likely to happen in terms of succession. And yeah, it's probably going to be like going from Blatter to Infantino, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. But what of just enclosing Jorge Vilda? Because he was one of the people who was clapping in that room. He's come out since with a very vanilla statement that he didn't necessarily agree with Rubiales' actions around the game. But I mean, clearly, and again, you mentioned in the Guardian article the politics behind Vilda being in place and why he's in place and how political it all is and how it's mutual favours and everything. I mean, I really thought, and again, this is where I've been naive, that he might think, do you know what? I've won the World Cup now. This is a bit of a toxic environment. No one really likes me. I'm going to bail now. I can probably, at this point, for the first time in my career, I can probably get a job somewhere else now because I've won the World Cup. Like, no one rated me as a coach. Now they might do and I can go somewhere else. But clearly he's been made an offer by Rubiales, a lucrative one that he's quite interested in. So I think Rubiales, I think you're right, eventually he'll go, but what happens after that is kind of open to question whether that will lead to any change. How do you see things panning out for Jorge Vilda?
I mean, I think you nailed it on the head there in the sense that, like, surely you're human enough and, you know, you have one working neuron is all you need to know, is that it's a good moment for you to walk away. You've been the manager for 8 years. You've gone to 2 World Cups. You won one of them. You know, apart from what an awful manager he is, his CV is good enough to be able to potentially to go on somewhere else. And in the lights of all of this, he's done nothing wrong except be a shit manager. So it's not like he has a spotlight on him. You know, everyone's wanted him gone for a very, very long time because he was a shit manager, point, period, blank. And you would think, and be like, resign, don't be involved with any of what the Federation is going through, because that the image of the Spanish Federation and Spanish football right now is just, you know, being dragged through the dirt. And, you know, leave. There's nothing, like, you have won the World Cup. There is literally nothing else that you can achieve with the national team from now on. And again, it's like, it's quite evident that nobody likes him. Like, yeah. That's no secret. And like, he's as dumb as he is, he definitely knows it. So it's like, yeah, it's quite bizarre to see. But again, it's, you know, one of the talks with Sonia Bermudez to take over as national team coach, and she was one of those from the national team that spoke up in 2015 against the Federation, and obviously now she's working with the Federation, and you have that controversy as to where she stands now. She's coaching the youth national teams, but again, like, there's no really, like, she just seems like another Jorge Vilda that it would potentially be too soon for her to take on the national team job. But because she is internal and because she's always been there, it's kind of, you know, those politics of we'd rather, you know, do this than actually get a manager who's set and ready for this. As Emma Hayes has also expressed her interest in coaching the national team. But within Spain, you know, you have the Real Sociedad manager, you have the Levante manager, you have Maria Pri as well, who's at Betis right now. These managers have proven themselves in Spanish football with Spanish footballers. So it's not like Spain has a shortage of managers to pick from. But yeah, it's just a matter of Jorge Vilda just being a parasite and getting whatever he can out of the Federation, even though it's just so just not a logical thing to do.
Yeah, you mentioned Maria Pri. I'd love to see it. That would be a real sign that things have changed. Maria Pri also used to coach at Levante and used to wear like a Minnie Mouse t-shirt on the sidelines.
Christian Chilo as well for the club I used to play for.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, very, very good coach and a very good personality. I think you'd know things really changed at the RFEF if she rocked up. But Alex, that's all we've got time for this episode. Really thank you for your insights on all three of those things, both the World Cup, Lea Cordina, and the fallout that continues around Spanish women's football. And I think we should shout out there probably haven't been enough male ally voices within Spanish football, but the likes of David De Gea, Hector Bellerin as well, someone listeners of our podcast will be very fond of, I'm sure. And I should have remembered the name of the Real Betis striker.
Borja Iglesias.
That's the one, yeah, who has said he won't play for Spain again while Rubiales is in situ. So we'll see how that all unfolds. That's all we've got time for this episode. I will be in Sweden next week, hoping to line up some kind of audio content. So I'm hopeful of being able to put out some kind of podcast next week from Linköping in Sweden. But until then, thanks again to Alex. And please do read that article in The Guardian that's in the show notes, because it sets out a lot of the history and the context of all of this kind of this whirlwind that has developed. But thanks very much for listening. And we will speak to you again next time.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.